Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. You can find the Commonwealth Club on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Stephen Zunis, Professor of Politics and Coordinator of the Middle Eastern Studies Program at the University of San Francisco, and your moderator for today's program. I am pleased to introduce our distinguished speaker, Eric Schmidt. He has been a reporter for the New York Times since 1983 and has covered military and national security affairs for the last two decades. He is the co-author of Counterstrike, the untold story of America's secret campaign against Al-Qaeda. Since the September 2001 attacks, he has covered American military operations, including many reporting trips to Iraq and Afghanistan. He has reported on counterterrorism operations in Pakistan, Mali, and Southeast Asia. Prior to that, he covered events in Haiti, Somalia, and actually lived in Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, covering the Persian Gulf War. He has covered the Pentagon, Congress, financial and business news, demographic and national immigration issues, commercial aviation, and the travel industry. Mr. Schmidt has two shared Pulitzer Prizes with reporting teams covering international stories. Schmidt is a Williams College graduate in international relations, studied at El Instituto Internacional in Madrid, attended Harvard University's Executive Program on National and International Security, and earned a Knight Journalism Fellowship at Stanford University. He is a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. We welcome him back home as he is a native of the San Francisco Bay Area. Please welcome Eric Schmidt.
Well, thank you very much for that very warm introduction, Stephen, and thanks to the Commonwealth Club for having me back. And it's great to be back in the Bay Area, particularly coming from Washington, D.C., where we thought once the election was over, all the scandals and controversy would be put behind us. Sorry to say. And in fact, it was interesting last week as we're wrestling with the ongoing civil war, of course, in Syria and the new dramatic developments between Israel and Hamas and the Gaza. I found myself in the basement of the Capitol building at a stakeout, waiting for Director Petraeus, kind of searching for Petraeus wherever he was. Kind of reminded me of covering the Monica Lewinsky scandal years ago and kind of the seedier side of journalism and where we've come from that and how those kind of things have become intertwined in national security today. What I'm going to do is talk a little bit about terrorism, which is the subject of the book that Tom Shanker and I wrote, but also try and address the current events as we're seeing them unfold quite rapidly today. But I'm going to talk about really the five phases of terrorism. As we look at it out today, there is the declining phase, the ascendant phase, the hidden phase of terrorism, a resurgent phase, and then really looking at kind of how the United States government, working with its allies, is addressing all of these different types of threats. The declining phase of terrorism is really where it all started on 9/11. That is, the Al-Qaeda leadership, headed by Osama bin Laden, of course, in Afghanistan at the time, and how, if there's a good news that's come out of the last decade, it's really that this leadership structure that was responsible for the attacks in Washington, New York, and the plane that went down in Pennsylvania, this leadership structure has been decimated. More than two dozen of the top leaders have been killed, punctuated, of course, by the Navy SEAL raid last year in Abbottabad, Pakistan, that killed bin Laden himself. And I think is when the investigators went in to look at the trove of information that the Navy SEALs took away from that safe house and looked at the CDs and the computers and the disk drives, what they saw was an Al-Qaeda leadership that, well, bin Laden may have been a little bit more engaged personally in some of the attacks, at least in the attack planning that was, even in his later years. It was really a leadership that was crumbling at its core, largely through some of the drone strikes that were hitting in Pakistan, the safe havens, This was a leadership structure that was in decline. It was in decline, but it certainly hadn't been ruled out altogether, and it isn't today. The remnants of the al-Qaeda leadership, headed by Ayman al-Zawahiri, are still hiding out in the tribal areas of Pakistan somewhere, still issuing online edicts, if you will, over the internet, and urging radicals wherever they are in the world, including here in the United States, to rise up and take on the West and take on the United States. They're still trying to get their hands on weapons of mass destruction, even if it's a radiological elements, and create a so-called dirty bomb to create havoc and chaos and wherever that might strike. But one of the most, I think, even as this leadership is in decline, it's dangerous for another reason, and that is because it continues to underscore the real sensitivity and weaknesses in the relationship with Pakistan. And as I think it was, we'll watch over the next couple of years as U.S. forces continue to withdraw from Afghanistan, and the focus continues to be there, and what will be the enduring United States presence after 2014, when the bulk of U.S. forces will leave Afghanistan, the bigger and larger strategic question for the United States will be Pakistan. This has always really been the key, and I think to some extent it's been somewhat on the side in the view of many because of the large number of U.S. forces in Afghanistan and all the attention paid to it. This is a country of 180 million people. It's nuclear armed, and it's bristling with tension still today, although albeit at a lower level with its neighbor to the east in India. So this is a key country, and watching how extremism plays out, not just al-Qaeda, but a kind of a witch's brew of different Islamic extremist groups that are harbored in not only the tribal areas of Pakistan, but in now many of the major cities in Pakistan itself. And so this is a potential tinderbox, not just for the United States, but for the region and really for the world, and watching how that plays out. So how that relationship is managed for the new Obama administration will be quite telling. That just because the drawdown is happening in Afghanistan, the focus will rightly be what happens next, what happens as the new leader of Afghanistan is elected after 2014, after President Karzai. Don't take your eye off what's going on next door, because that really will, I think, be a larger key to what's going on in the stability of the region overall. The other thing, of course, that the campaign against al-Qaeda has underscored is the use of drones. The use of drones in Pakistan have proved to be an essential tactical weapon at going after that leadership. Most of those two dozen senior leadership figures that I talked about before were killed in drone strikes. But there's been a price to pay for that. For each one of those leaders that's been taken out by a drone strike, it has engendered increased the antipathy toward the United States on the ground, and has really fueled anti-American resentment in Pakistan. On my last trip to Pakistan, just less than a year ago, I was basically restricted to working in Islamabad instead of going up into Peshawar, the gateway to the tribal areas, just because the tensions were really probably greater, I think, for Western correspondents working there than they had been before. So watching that will be very key, I think, in all. So that's the good news in this relationship. The not so good news is kind of the second phase of terrorism, and that is those elements that are on the rise. And if you think about that main al-Qaeda leadership in Pakistan that's been chipped away at over the years by the U.S. and its allies, what you've seen is the opposite happening around the rest of the world. Al-Qaeda has franchises that have been developing in different areas, feeding off some local resentments and indignities, and working in a way that they've been able to create affiliates that have carried on the al-Qaeda global message in places like Iraq, which in large part the al-Qaeda brand had been driven out with the surge that General David Petraeus helped lead several years ago. And what we're now seeing is a resurgent al-Qaeda in Iraq that's not only playing havoc in Iraq itself, but it's sending in fighters and some leaders into neighboring Syria and exacerbating the civil war there, so stirring things up in that regard. You have the al-Qaeda elements in East Africa that still pose a problem. You have the East Africa affiliates in what's called the Islamic Maghreb, AQIM as it's now called, which are playing a very important role in destabilizing impoverished countries in Northwest Africa, such as Mali, and has played a very important role in this ongoing controversial subject of what happened 2 months ago in the attack on the U.S. diplomatic mission in Benghazi, Libya, that killed Ambassador Chris Stevens and three other Americans. It appears now there were elements of this Al-Qaeda franchise that were on the ground that day, working in conjunction with a local Libyan extremist group. So you have, with the fall of the Gaddafi regime in Libya and that security element that was able to keep a lid to some extent on some of these extremist groups, that has now unleashed forces and unleashed these elements that Al-Qaeda is trying to move into and exploit. They're very good at exploiting chaos and uncertainty, and that's what they're doing in many of these countries, whether it be in Egypt, in Tunisia, and of course in Libya, where we saw it so regretfully in the attacks in the Benghazi area. But no franchise is of more concern of all of these than the franchise that is now in Yemen. It's what they call Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And this is the franchise, of course, that was responsible for the so-called underpants bomber, the young Nigerian man who had a bomb strapped in his groin and tried to blow up a plane over Detroit, Christmas Day 2009. 10 months later, the same organization was able to pack explosives into printer cartridges, put them on a couple of cargo planes bound for the United States, and but for a tip from Saudi intelligence, those planes could have exploded somewhere over Europe or over the United States as well, creating great, great tragedy there. Just earlier this year, you had the incident of Underpants Bomber 2.0, new and improved timing device, double triggers, if you will, so that the mechanism could go off more effectively than it did last time, in hopes. And the only thing that really saved us then, I think, was the fact that the man that AQAP had recruited for that mission turned out to be a double agent, somebody working for American and British and Saudi intelligence as well. Somebody so close, he was able to get the trust of the Al-Qaeda leadership in Yemen and carry out that plot. So we have these franchises that are carrying out, in many cases, the goals of global Al-Qaeda in taking on that mission and doing those kind of things. If you look at the shift in balance in how these groups kind of align, it's interesting, again, using these drone strikes as a measurement. At the peak level, the drone strikes in Pakistan were up well over 150 drone strikes in a year. They're down now this year roughly around 30 or 40. In Yemen alone this year, there have been nearly 60 drone strikes against targets in that country. As that government, which was replaced in February by a new leader, tries to regain the territory that it lost, particularly in the south, and deal with a whole host of problems and shortfalls that they have there, Al-Qaeda has been trying to exploit those weaknesses as well and transport and export their violence to other countries and going on around there. Phase three of this terrorist movement that we're watching is what I call the hidden threat, and that is the homegrown threat here in the United States. And it's taken on a couple of different dimensions. You have individuals such as Najibullah Zazi, who is a young Afghan immigrant who was a pushcart vendor in New York City, later became a shuttle bus driver in Denver. And he was somebody who was trained over in Afghanistan, in Pakistan, by the Al-Qaeda elements there. And he had a plot that he cooked up to carry out backpack bombings in the New York City subways in 2009. And only a tip that was intercepted from one of his tutors, really, in Pakistan, when he called back because he couldn't get the formula right for the explosive that he was going to use in the detonation. He was actually calling back saying the recipe doesn't work. He was in a suburban hotel in Denver, and he couldn't quite get the mix to work. And it was just because of that one intercept that they were able to, the authorities were intercept him and follow him to New York where they figured out what he was up to there. Or you had an example such as a man named Faisal Shahzad, a Pakistani-American who seemed to have everything going for him. He was a financial analyst for Elizabeth Arden, living in the suburbs of Connecticut with his wife and a couple kids. And yet he was returning home to Pakistan, and each time he did, he stayed a little bit longer because he was becoming radicalized by what he saw with the drone strikes in the tribal areas and the increasing tensions that he saw between Israel and the Palestinians, to the point where he volunteered to go train with the Pakistani Taliban, who again gave him some lessons on how to make your own bomb. And the only reason that the bomb that he put together in an SUV that he put in Times Square in 2010 was he used the wrong kind of fertilizer, a fertilizer that wouldn't explode, like the kind that took out the huge explosion that Timothy McVeigh used, of course, in Oklahoma City. So we, the United States, in this case, got lucky a few times. If you go back and look at it, whether it be the underpants bomber, whether it be Najibullah Zazi's potential subway attack, or the SUV attack in Times Square, the heart of Midtown Manhattan, these have all been avoided in just a few cases. These are instances where American citizens now were involved in doing these kind of things, training abroad. But the plot thickens because what you have now today are Americans who, in the privacy of their homes, are actually able to watch online videos, English language videos, that are created in large part by a man named Anwar al-Awlaki, who was an American-born cleric who preached in mosques in Northern Virginia and San Diego, and who had, up until the time of his death last year in a drone strike in Yemen, had become probably the single most effective propagandist because he spoke fluent, idiomatic English. He knew the vulnerabilities of the American society. He knew the vulnerabilities of young people, particularly young males, and how to get to them and how to radicalize them and get to them in that way. So that now the FBI and police say that is one of the hardest things to detect. How do you detect an individual in the privacy of their homes on their own computers going to some of these chat rooms or other forums? How do you identify them who may be the ones who get the recipe right next time, who plant the next car bomb, perhaps here in San Francisco or in some other major city? This is the threat that lives with us all the time. Phase four is what I call a resurgent threat. This is a threat that's been with us for some time, but over the last decade, we haven't seen much of it, and that is the rise of state-sponsored terrorism, particularly from Iran. And if you think about it, over the last decade, the focus has been on Sunni-based terrorism, al-Qaeda. But what we have last seen, particularly in the last year and a half or 2 years, particularly as the tensions between the United States, Israel, and Iran have heightened over Iran's nuclear program, you have now seen a covert war go overt. You have Iranian scientists, nuclear scientists, mysteriously being assassinated. You have, on the other side, Israeli terrorists and diplomats being targeted in places like Bangkok and the Republic of Georgia. You have the United States now acknowledging, in my colleague David Sanger's very good book, the role that Stuxnet, a cyber virus, played in basically foiling the centrifuges that are so critical to the Iranian nuclear program. And so this is a covert war that's been underway now that is now coming to the surface. And when we see Iran now, a Shia-based terrorism organization, using its own forces, they're called the Quds Force, the Iranian IRGC, working for them, or working in conjunction with Hezbollah, a Lebanese-based Shia organization, and seeing them, how they carry out, to the extent that some of these plots are so remarkable on the face of it, that the most crazy one seemed to be the one last fall where Quds Force operators were intercepted, apparently after trying to recruit a member of the Zetas drug cartel to assassinate the Saudi ambassador to the United States at his favorite restaurant in Washington, D.C. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. And yet that's kind of where we are today in the war on terror. So how will all of this end? Where are we heading in this kind of war on terrorism now? It's a much more complicated, much more diverse type of threat than I think we saw on 9/11 itself. And as Tom and I lay out in our book, there are a number of things to watch. First of all, I think what's happened, there have been a number of things since 9/11. On 9/11 itself, the U.S. government knew very little about al-Qaeda as a terrorist organization. It knew very little about how al-Qaeda interacted with other terrorist groups. What we now have, and 10 years later, is a much better understanding of al-Qaeda. You almost want to think of al-Qaeda as al-Qaeda Inc., a corporation, if you will, that has an HR department that goes out and tries to find fighters. It has a housing department that finds safe houses on where to put these fighters. It has a whole benefits department for the families, for what happens after the fighters are killed in suicide attacks. And so the idea that you have, it's a network, really, the way these terrorist organizations are set up. And so how you combat that is as a network. How do you identify nodes of that network that are most vulnerable? And that gets to the approach that's changed so much since 9/11 in battling terrorists. On 9/11 itself, shortly thereafter, I think the main emphasis using the military and intelligence services was to kill and capture the enemy. If you kill and captured enough of the fighters, kill and captured enough of the commanders, the organization would implode on itself. That was the thinking at the time. What it underestimated and really didn't understand, however, was the ideology. The ideology and the driving motivation at work for Al-Qaeda. And it's a narrative that's still very powerful today, even though the brand of Al-Qaeda has been tarnished somewhat by some of its suicide bombings. And that message today is that the West and the United States is at war with Islam. It's a false narrative, to be sure, but it's one that resonates with particularly young males around the Middle East and North Africa. And Al-Qaeda, all Al-Qaeda has to do is point as examples to the tens of thousands of troops that were in Iraq until just last year, the tens of thousands of troops that remain in Afghanistan and will do so at least through 2014, the drone strikes that continue in countries like Pakistan and Somalia and Yemen, and of course these tensions and the U.S. support for Israel in its ongoing fight with Hamas. This is a narrative that fuels the recruiting base for Al-Qaeda and its different franchises and continues to draw upon in a very powerful way. So how do you get at that? Well, fortunately, over the last 10 years, there have been a lot of improvements, not only at the U.S. level in the breaking down of barriers and sharing intelligence among the various agencies. You now have the State Department and its diplomats playing a much more important role in trying to get at the root causes of terrorism overseas. The FBI now deploys scores of agents overseas to work with law enforcement there to try and combat the problem. Even the Treasury Department now plays an instrumental role in trying to identify and track and stamp out terrorist financing, which is really the lifeblood of organizations like Al-Qaeda in doing that. So it's a much more holistic approach to fighting terrorism, not only within the United States government, but also working with its international allies. Because Al-Qaeda and groups like Al-Qaeda are transnational terrorist groups. They don't respect or honor boundaries. And to fight them, the United States and its allies also cannot do that as well. You have to fight together. And so that's where there's been a lot more collaboration. One thing we talk about in the book is a new wrinkle, though, in how you tackle that. It's not just with bullets and diplomacy and others. It's through a novel way of how you think about deterrence. Now, most of you may think of, as we did before we started research, as deterrence was the key concept that kept a tense peace between the U.S. and the Soviet Union during the Cold War. And that's great. But what we discovered was that there was actually some very creative thinking going on deep in the bowels of the Pentagon about people who were Cold War scholars, but they started to think, is there a way that we can use deterrence against terrorists? And when they floated this theory, people said, no, you can't do that. How can you do that? Because deterrence is based on targeting fixed things and holding physical things at risk for us and the U.S. It was holding things like the Soviet missile bases and buildings, the Kremlin, for instance, at risk of attack. But what these scholars and individuals in the Pentagon realized was that while Al-Qaeda and people like Osama bin Laden may not have physical things that you can target, because this is, after all, an elusive organization with no headquarters down at the corner of 4th and Main that you can strike, they had what the research discovered were virtual values. These are the values, for instance, of honor and prestige and their place within the Muslim community. And so how can you identify those values and prey upon them, for instance? How can you exploit those as you exploit those nodes of the terrorist network, perhaps to be more effective? And the one story that I'll tell from our book to illustrate that involves a particular virulent cell in Afghanistan that was attacking U.S. forces and coalition troops there. And the leader was a guy named Ahmed. And the U.S. decided the only way to take down this cell was to go after Ahmed. And the thinking was, well, we'll do what any Western, good Western society would do. We'll put out a reward for him. Well, that didn't work. It didn't work for two reasons. One, because half the people were scared to death that if they turned in Ahmed, he would come back to kill them and their family. But the other half was secretly sympathizing with Ahmed. So the fighting continues. The Americans are thinking, how are we going to get to this problem? Until they realized, they heard about some of this new deterrence thinking that was going on in Washington. And so what they did, working with their Afghan allies, was instead of raising the bounty on Ahmed's head, they lowered the bounty. And then they put the word out through their surrogates in the marketplaces that Ahmed wasn't nearly the terrorist that he used to be. After all, when was the last time you've seen him? He's been in hiding, which he was, because he was keeping good operational security. Oh, and did you hear? Most of Ahmed's fighters are defecting because he can't meet the payroll anymore. Such a shame. He was such a good terrorist while it lasted. Well, you can eventually figure out who heard this eventually, and it was Ahmed. And he was so pissed off. He got up on his cell phone and he started calling around to his lieutenants to make sure they really hadn't defected. That's exactly what the Americans wanted. Because one of the other major themes of the last 10 years in fighting terrorism is the tremendous advances that U.S. technology has made, particularly in the so-called areas of intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. How the U.S. technology is able to suck up electronic communications, be they from cell phones, telephones, computers, whatever it is, turn that quickly around, get that information to people like the Navy SEALs on the ground, and go after terrorists. So these are the kind of techniques that the U.S. is now using, going into cyberspace and spoofing the terrorists where they live, using weapons when they need to, as they did in the SEAL attack, but also getting inside of the terrorist's head and you know, basically messing with them when they did, like they did with Ahmed. Where does that leave us today, though? As we lay out in our book, and as I try to lay out in this brief presentation, the threats are still very real here, to the point where we argue there will be another terrorist attack in the United States. We can't predict exactly when or where. The whole process is to try and push that attack as far down the road as possible and hopefully reduce its ferocity. But what we haven't done a good job, we argue, and what political leaders haven't done a good job, is really instilling a sense of resilience in the American public. And by that, we don't mean physical resilience. Because I think a lot of what we've seen, the rebuilding down at in lower Manhattan, has been quite remarkable. We're talking about is psychological resilience, the kind of resilience that the Israelis have and the Brits have, countries that have gone through their own spates of domestic terrorism and have come through stronger for it. Large part because their approach has been when they're hit with an attack, they mourn their dead, they clean up the debris, and then they move on. They don't overreact to the terrorist attack. And I think that's the message here for Americans today as we try and understand the threat and try and understand the balance between with our government in trying to understand what the threat is and what information the government can release to us so we're educated and we can understand what is and isn't a real threat. And also the balance with operational security. Because one of the things I think the problem after 9/11 was, we tended to equate, along with government, that the threat from Al-Qaeda was akin to the threat the Soviet Union placed. It was an existential threat, it was argued, when in fact that's never been the case. And I think that's one of the great challenges, of course, today, is how you combat that. And as President Obama now gathers for a second term and is looking to gather new people to populate his second term in security, he's going to have to be looking at these kind of challenges. People argue that some of what he had in place was to run for re-election. And many of the issues we've now seen that were basically put on hold, how do you deal with Syria? How do you deal with terrorism? How do you deal with the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt? Many of these issues perhaps have been put on hold. Now, of course, he's not going to be running for re-election after this point. And so I think he's looking at a different kind of team that will be put together over the next few weeks. This is a team he thought he was going to have to be dealing just replacing Secretary Clinton and Secretary Panetta. But now, obviously, it deals with a new CIA director at probably a very pivotal time to be losing somebody like David Petraeus. But these are the challenges ahead that this government faces and that we face as an American people. Anyway, thank you very much for your attention, and I look forward to your questions today.
Our thanks to Eric Schmidt, national security reporter for the New York Times and co-author of Counterstrike, the untold story of America's secret campaign against Al-Qaeda. It's now time for our audience question period, and we do have a number of questions, so let's begin. Both liberals and conservatives at various times have acknowledged that there is a connection between the disproportionate number of authoritarian regimes in the Middle East and the presence of terrorist groups and other extremist movements. Despite that, of course, the United States remains arguably the number one military and security backer of these remaining authoritarian regimes. But things are starting to change, of course. We see the Arab Spring, and part of Bin Laden's narrative was that the only way we can overthrow these Western installed dictatorships is through adopting our medievalist reactionary brand of Islam and engaging in terrorist tactics. And yet we've seen in Tunisia and Egypt and to some extent even in Yemen, the power of mass strategic nonviolent action. That there are alternative ways of bringing down dictatorships than through violence. And has this impacted Al-Qaeda's ability to recruit and to gain new adherents?
It's interesting you ask that, Stephen, because I think one of the things, not only was the U.S. government caught off guard by the Arab Spring, but so was Al-Qaeda. As you've accurately pointed out, they had been espousing this very radical, extreme violent view of how you take down these different governments. And they were caught flat-footed by this, frankly. But Al-Qaeda, if nothing else, is a very adaptable, nimble organization, both its headquarters and its different affiliates. And so what they've been doing very quickly is trying to fill the gaps, fill the vacuum, if you will, in some of the security elements areas of these countries. And so that's why you're seeing in countries like Libya, where they don't have strong security forces anymore. Certainly in Yemen, that's the case. And as I think we even see in countries like Egypt, there's a struggle now in terms of these various groups. So Al-Qaeda, while still very much of a minority within the Sunni religion, some would say it's hijacked the Sunni religion, extremist views, it's trying to exploit those areas where it can still motivate young people and still have a cause. And I think we see that in Syria. And one of the things I know in talking to officials in the Obama administration and other governments, Western governments, is the longer the civil war in Syria goes on, for instance, the longer it gives time for these extremist groups, including elements of Al-Qaeda, to make inroads, to basically co-opt some of the legitimate or more legitimate rebel organizations, whether it be with arms or their ideology and recruitment. And particularly as the fighting escalates, as the Assad government in Syria escalates their fighting, and the opposition forces feel they're not getting enough arms from the West, who will they turn to? They will turn to some of these more extremist elements, basically for survival. And so I think that's going to be one of the biggest challenges that the West faces as it watches this civil war starting not only to take on greater violence in Syria, but start to spill across its borders into places like Turkey and Lebanon. This is going to be one of the great challenges, is how do you, in a sense, manage this kind of crisis? It's very, very difficult to do.
Well, you have referred to the policy of assassination by drones as one of the United States' most effective tools in combating militancy. Now, obviously, there have been some moral and legal questions raised, but some have also raised questions about the efficacy, particularly in Yemen, where it appears to have driven a number of key tribal leaders into alliance with Al-Qaeda. Do you still believe that on balance, drone strikes still serve U.S. strategic interests? And has the New York Times Freedom of Information Act request of the Obama administration's targeting decisions provide any insights?
Well, we're still trying to get more information from that FOIA request, Stephen. Mm-hmm. I think what we've seen in countries like Pakistan and Yemen and Somalia is that as a tactic, drones have largely been very effective in taking out key leaders. To be sure, in each of those countries, there have been mistakes made that, as you said, have been counterproductive in it's pushed some of the groups that were on the ground, maybe that were fence sitters, over to the side of the extremist group, the Al-Qaeda affiliate. The danger, I think, in Washington is they've seen the success of these, particularly in places like Pakistan, is to think we can use this not just as a tactic, but drones can be a strategy unto themselves. And that really just won't work as a long-term prospect. I think this administration, what it's tried to do in countries like Yemen and Pakistan, is to go in with small number of advisors, be they military advisors, CIA advisors, or whatever, and try and build up the indigenous security forces so they can fight the threat, not the United States. We've seen that in some of the African countries as well, North African countries where this has been the problem. The trouble is, this is a long-term solution. What happens in the short term? If you're John Brennan, President Obama's counterterrorism czar, what do you do about that intelligence report that says there is a plot that's cooking right now about somebody who's going to get on an airplane and try and blow themselves up? That long-term strategy doesn't impact that. And so that's where they reach out to that tool, whether it be a drone or a commando raid, and unfortunately there's blowback from that. And the challenge for this administration, and any administration for that matter, is weighing those short-term consequences of dealing with an immediate threat to the security of the United States and its interests, that longer-term solution, and how one is not necessarily going to support the other. It's a great challenge right now.
This is a reminder that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club radio program, and our guest is Eric Schmidt, national security reporter for the New York Times and co-author of Counterstrike, the untold story of America's secret campaign against Al-Qaeda. Let me take advantage of the moderator's chair and ask a personal question. We are coming up to the 10th anniversary of the Iraq War. I was one of those who argued that the evidence seemed to indicate that Iraq no longer had an active chemical, biological, or nuclear weapons program, much less any weapons. And yet, even though our analysis proved correct, the New York Times largely dismissed our research and instead provided extensive coverage to those making what ended up being false claims about weapons of mass destruction. And I was wondering, why did the Times choose to ignore us? Have there been any improvements in taking a more skeptical view of exaggerated claims of foreign countries' military capabilities?
Well, it's a good question, and you put a good point on. I mean, the New York Times did not do its usual, I think, aggressive and best reporting on the Iraq. And our former executive editor, Bill Keller, made that quite clear in a long editor's note, acknowledged that we should have been challenging the assumptions that the Bush administration was placing its decision to go to war in Iraq on. That said, I think what it's done is it's provided a pretty good lesson for us as we move forward in our coverage of Iran and be much more skeptical about the claims of just how far along Iran is in its nuclear program, what threat does it pose, not only to the United States, but of course to Israel, and how the U.S. and Israel are not always on the same page when it comes to that, just obviously because of Israel's proximity to Iran and that. So I think journalistically, sure, we took a hit on the Iraq coverage and we could have done better. I think we've learned from those lessons, however, and are now looking much more skeptically. I know certainly senior editors at the New York Times, including my boss, Jill Abramson, who will be speaking here later, we are all addressing these questions in a very focused way. The problem with this, of course, is you're dealing with highly classified information, both in terms of what is known about Iran's nuclear program. It's imperfect knowledge, and so it's not just what the U.S. knows, but it's pooling information, what other governments' intelligence services know as well, and weighing that against, of course, trying to divine what's inside the head of the Iranian leaders. Very, very difficult to do, whether it's Iran or North Korea or any of these governments that are very close in its decision-making.
We have a number of questions related to the Petraeus affair, and I imagine forgive the double entendre. And of course, you know, here you have two very explosive topics of national security and sex coming together. I mean, there's a, you know, obviously lots of pressure on people in your position, national security reporters, to quickly sort through potential layers of opinion, rumor, incorrect or misleading information. As a journalist, what's your process on a story that's obviously hot and that's, you know, clearly going to be front page news. I'd be interested in hearing some of the process about, you know, fact checker sources. How long does it take to take? Who edits you?
Yeah. Well, let me walk you through what happened at the New York Times that day. I was in a briefing at the Pentagon on a totally unrelated subject, and I was looking down at my BlackBerry, and it was one of those moments where I think a lot of reporters were, and all of a sudden people started filtering out of the room, and for a very strange reason. Even though it was a very important briefing, it was what the Pentagon was basically laying out its timeline of what it knew when and how it responded to the attack on the diplomatic mission in Benghazi. Not a small incidental subject. But as I look down at mine, you're getting a statement from the Director of National Intelligence saying that David Petraeus has resigned because of an extramarital affair. That gets your attention. It got the attention of several of my colleagues as we work collaboratively as a national security team. And of course, the first order of business was trying to find out what happened here. Who was this woman? What were the implications for General Petraeus and this administration? Was national security in some way compromised? What was at stake here? And so we mobilized. It was pretty much of an all hands on deck call, where people were calling all their possible sources in the government. David Petraeus, of course, is someone who has worked the media assiduously in his time. I've known him since he was a colonel over 20 years, and so we have long-standing professional relationships with him. He's been somebody who has taken time to explain the complexities of missions, whether they be in Iraq or Afghanistan or others, to reporters. And so it was mind-boggling, to say the least, to say that he is self-disciplined as somebody like David Petraeus would be caught up in something like this. The other thing, people were very well aware of Paula Broadwell, his biographer, somebody we had met, journalists had met. She described herself at times as journalist. She showed up at conferences. I'd met her briefly at an Aspen Institute conference just this past summer, where she was on a media panel. And so the first thought was Paula Broadwell. But then people thought, well, that couldn't be. It's too obvious. You know, they were like out there all the time. And she'd written this very kind of fawning, adulation of this biography of General Petraeus that didn't seem to sit well with many of his top staff and people that knew him. But that aside, there'd been never any real rumors that they'd actually had in a physical affair. So this struck us as just, tremendous. So there were people trying to find out, more from her and find out what was this, what were the circumstances. People were trying to, identify what was going on with Petraeus. When did people know? What was the timeline here? When did this happen? Did it happen while he was still on active duty as commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan? That was very important, because if so, he would be subject to the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which prohibits adultery. Or did it happen after he came back to the United States and took up his duties as director of the CIA? In either case, how could this happen? I mean, he has people, security around him all the time. You would think somebody would notice, or it'd be enough of an inhibition to deflect that. Well, anyway, so this is the Friday night. This is the classic bad news lands on a Friday night story. And we're funneling it. Just very mechanically how it worked was there were at least 6 to 8 reporters, and we're all funneling our reporting into one of my colleagues, Michael Scheer, who did a brilliant job of pulling us all together in kind of the classic rewrite man function. So we had a very strong page one story the next day. It actually got up online, of course, much sooner, because our lives live online these days on the web. And Michael also did it, pulled together on a very short notice a quick profile of who Paula Broadwell was. We, at the same time, my colleague Scott Shane, who was covering this, was put in charge of writing a big story of kind of how all this happened. What did people know, and how did this all put together in David Petraeus, and who was David Petraeus, and his impact American society, and of course is one of the leading generals of his generation. And so we're caught, because Friday is a tough, just again talking mechanically here, is a very tough day for us, because we're basically putting out two papers at once. The Sunday paper is put together, as many of you know, you get sections earlier. Some of those are done way in advance. But many of the stories that we write for the front page of the Sunday paper have to be done, if not Friday night, Saturday morning, because they go to a very early edition that's then sent out to the hinterlands around the United States. And so poor Scott is pulling together from feeds from different colleagues. He stays up until 3:30 in the morning pulling together this massive 2,200-word piece on Petraeus and what this all means, so it can land and be edited by editors in Washington, then in New York, somewhere between 8 a.m. and 10 a.m., and then it can be then put up online quickly within the next few hours, and then the print editions get into the distribution cycle. This story, while it appears online, is being constantly updated on the web, as all our stories are now, too, and as we have several editions running on the Sunday paper. At the same time, you have editors, looking ahead to Enterprise stories, trying to understand what was the means of the electronic means of the exchanges? And of course, this quickly gets into, you know, how did we even find out about this? It, again, you can hardly make this stuff up. It turns out Paula Broadwell was sending harassing emails to a Tampa socialite, a woman named Jill Kelly, who is someone who supports, you know, a supporter of military circles in Tampa, which is home of the U.S. Central Command and Special Operations Command. And she's the one who basically was getting these anonymous emails saying, you know, don't you dare get near David Petraeus, and I know you're going to be meeting with for lunch with him and somebody else this time. And so she looked at these, and she turned to a friend of hers, an FBI agent in the Tampa field office, and said, what do you make of these? This is kind of, not only is it creepy, but we're worried, she claims, that this could be somebody who's not just stalking me, but stalking General Petraeus, as it turns out, another very senior officer. So they turn it over to the cyber squad in Tampa, which is kind of unusual. The FBI gets all sorts of requests that come in over the transom from spurned lovers and jilted, you know, business people, all sorts of things. But because she had a connection and they felt, you know, she was prominent in these Tampa circles, they would at least check it out. And as they started peeling back the layers and where these anonymous emails were coming from, they got in much deeper than they ever thought they were going to. Once they discover through this the relationship between Broadwell and Petraeus, raising questions of whether, you know, this affair could be used as blackmail against Director Petraeus. That raises the national security element in here. And then, of course, it turned out one of these emails that was sent out not only to Jill Kelly, but was sent to General John Allen, former commander at CENTCOM, now four-star commander in Afghanistan, due to be promoted. And he's got it ensnared in this whole thing because he's returning all these emails to Jill Kelly. Some of them reportedly are of a sexually explicit nature. His associates say, no, it's not that. He's a southern gentleman. These are just terms of endearment. So we'll see. But meantime, what you have here is you have the Department of Defense's Inspector General checking out the emails from between Allen and Jill Kelly. You have the FBI that's now looking into Paula Broadwell to see if she had classified information in her emails. They both swear Petraeus didn't give it to her. And then you have the CIA Inspector General who's doing his own investigation into whether or not Director Petraeus misused the perks of his position, private planes, security details, and such, to facilitate his affair. So this thing is not going away.
Well, speaking of embedding journalists with the military,
what
do you think about the practice of embedding journalists into units? I mean, do you think it gets in the way of objectivity, particularly, say, in a counterinsurgency situation where, for example, the views of the civilian population need to be considered and the like?
The embedding program served a very important function. It's actually kind of on its way out just because the large-scale wars that we've had in Afghanistan and Iraq now for over the last 10 years are winding down, and reporters that do go over there, both by dint of their ingenuity and their own technology, they don't really embed anymore. But what the embedding program did was a very valuable function. It put you in that place where you were right next to the soldier or the Marine or the airman who was carrying out the fight. And it gave, I think, it allowed many journalists who'd never been exposed to the military, first of all, to get a different view of that. And in doing so, we were able to portray that view, that very soda straw view of what was going on in a military action to American readers or viewers. That said, it can't be relied on all by itself as a reporting tool. You need to have the broad picture as well, because the longer you stay with the unit, you're going to actually bond with those guys, and you're going to take on some of their views, perhaps. So what the most effective embedding program journalistically is when it's augmented and supplemented by broader coverage, by colleagues that are in Washington or based in various in Baghdad or in Kabul, for instance, writing about what's going on. So it becomes a very important insight into one aspect of a military campaign in particular, but it can't be relied upon all by itself.
Well, how would you describe, actually, what is the best language in terms of framing the struggle that the United States continues to have with Al-Qaeda and with Al-Qaeda wannabe kind of organizations? We have one question talks about, is the U.S. at war with radical Islam? And if so, how is that nuanced with the claim that we are not at war with Islam itself? Is the term, you know, war on terror, given how
broad that can be, and how many groups it could include, and how often the definition of a terrorist group can be politically loaded. If you could be the one who could shape the vocabulary of how we discuss this ongoing struggle, how would you word it?
Well, we talk in our book. We talk about the new Darwinism, if you will, and that is how you have the United States and its allies in violent extremism on the other side, and one side is constantly trying to get the advantage over the other. And it's a very much of an evolving, adaptive process, whether it's in the tactics, whether it's in the operations, whether it's in the strategy and ideology. This is a very fluid and fast-moving type of operation. And so you can't just think of it as a set-piece battle that you might have in World War II or in the Korean War. This is something that's going to last for a very long time. It may take different forms in different places, but we are going to see an aggressive campaign, certainly not only by this administration, but by the following administrations. And the goal, of course, is to drive down the violence associated with terrorism to a level that local authorities can deal with. The goal of Al-Qaeda is to elevate that threat to a global basis that can knit together all these disparate type of insurgencies around the world into a global movement that propels itself in one direction. And so this is going to be the struggle out there. And it's a struggle. That's why when I talked about this more holistic approach, it's sometimes the best tool is going to be the commando raid. You need the military tool to go in because there are people like the bin Ladens or the suicide bombers that are never going to be deterred and will do all they can to carry out violence. But on the other hand, there's much to be said about what the State Department and diplomats do in trying to provide just stronger democratic institutions, not even necessarily democratic, because that sometimes is a loaded word in different countries, but more representative forms of government, rule of law, improving economy, simply getting people where they can have jobs for their young people out there. So there's a sense of hope. I mean, so much of what drives Al-Qaeda's narrative is a sense of hopelessness and nihilism, and that if they play on that, that's where they're pulling in a lot of their recruits. What other choice do they have? Whereas if you're a young Muslim male and you're getting promises of all those virgins in heaven and your family is going to get death payments when you leave, I mean, what's to think about? I mean, your situation, if you're living in Gaza right now, in a congested territory right now, or in Yemen or someplace like that, and you suddenly can think about why that's important. But this is very difficult, I think, for particularly Western governments and Western thinkers to put their arms around. They want to kind of box this in, have a very logical strategy to go after it. And the idea that you can have this enduring ideology that in many cases go back centuries, and people who have a time frame that's so much longer term than ours. I mean, the Al-Qaeda fighter today knows that he is just fighting for the moment, but the ultimate cause is going to be won generations after he is gone. And he's comfortable with that. And it's just a mindset that's very difficult to combat if you don't think about it in those terms initially.
I'd like to turn to Iran. We have a question about Iranian-sponsored terrorism. We all know that Iran has indeed supported in various ways extremist organizations. At the same time, when I turn on the radio or television, half the time the people who are talking about Iran's connection to terrorism are from the same neoconservatives who had grossly exaggerated claims of Saddam's connection to terrorism. But what in your research and your reporting, what is your assessment of exactly what kind of terrorism is Iran directly supporting at this point?
Well, one way to think about it is put yourself in Iran's position. Suddenly you're in the Middle East and you feel almost as if you're surrounded, whether it's by American allies or Western allied countries that are gunning for you. And you feel you have a legitimate right to develop nuclear power. Whether you need that nuclear weapons program or not is another matter. And suddenly you see your scientists being assassinated. And this is a view that the West is kind of coming in to constrict you. I'm not saying this view is right or not, but it is a view of trying to get inside the Iranian mentality and how they might respond to this. And so I think what you're seeing is an outgrowth of that, where you have the IRGC that's right now basically the instrument of the supreme leader in carrying out I think, various terrorist attacks. It's essentially not only in retaliation, but in trying to pushing back the West and trying to establish themselves, what they view as their legitimate right to operate within the Middle East, doing that. Of course, that is at odds with all kind of legalistic structures that we're seeing in terms of what Iran, in terms of signing up for the agreements that they have in particularly with our nuclear weapons program and dealing with that. So the challenge, I think, for the United States and the West now is how do, and we'll probably be seeing some of this, as the discussions of whether you'll have direct talks between the Obama administration and Iran now unfold, whether those will actually come to be now in the next coming months, and whether you can basically ratchet down the tensions between these two governments. Because right now, the previous administration's position was trying to delay the ability of Iran to acquire nuclear weapons, which has been a red line for American administrations and for the Israeli government as well, and hopefully to a point when the Iranian people can install a new form of government, a more representative government that's more sympathetic to the West, not necessarily in agreement completely with the West, but not completely hostile to it as well. It's a strategy of kind of pushing off and delaying to try and get the Iranian people to replace the mullahs that are in Iran now and in Tehran. It's again a longer-term strategy that right now is based on these very tough sanctions that the West has put into place and that by all accounts are having a real bite. Whether it'll be enough, have enough bite to force Iran to alter its weapons program, we'll see.
Well, you have been with the New York Times for close to 30 years now. And so I wanted to shift the focus a little bit just in terms of your experiences as a reporter. When you started, of course, you were using a typewriter. There was the print edition was the only edition of the New York Times. I was wondering if you could share some about how things have changed, the whole multi-platform 24-hour news cycle, and what does that, how does that change the life of a reporter?
Sure. It's actually made reporters' work much more challenging in many ways because of that multi-platform requirement, but in many ways it can also be much more enriching. At the New York Times, for instance, if you're traveling with Secretary Clinton or Secretary Panetta, you are filing for a number of what we now call platforms in the paper. You're filing for the web. You may have a blog that you're filing to. If something really important, you could be on a Twitter account and sending that out information. And, of course, the New York Times still owns several different print editions. There's the New York Times proper, but we also own the International Herald Tribune. So if you're traveling in Asia, as my colleague Elizabeth B. Miller was recently, you're having to file for the Asia version of the New York Times, the International Herald Tribune. But then you've got a European edition as well that's filing. So you're almost in a mode of a wire reporter in terms of trying to keep up to date, oftentimes with a new top to the story to make it fresher or to tailor to that audience. So it's a remarkably challenging environment right now to keep up with and to kind of try and marshal the information that's coming in. My colleagues on the political trail right now, in the recently completed campaign, just did an amazing job. And this is a campaign that journalistically is fought out over Twitter, basically. The Twitter feeds are driving much of the coverage in terms of how campaigns are reacting to the latest developments, how reporters putting out tweets and then having them responded to by the spokesman for the various campaigns were driving it. And the last thing that went into the paper was the print story and there's the whole challenge of how do you make that seem fresh after you've had this whole kind of array of news stories up on the web all day. That all said, there's so much more we can do journalistically now than when I started, as you said, almost 30 years ago. In a big enterprise story, say one that my colleague Chris Chivers and I worked on late last year, we were looking at the impact of civilian casualties of the NATO bombing of Libya. Well, we had a big 3,500-word story that went on the web. We had our big print story that was in the paper, but we had a slideshow from photographers that joined us. Chris and some of our colleagues in the graphics department were able to go in and do individual web narratives, if you will, on each of the various sites where there were reported civilian casualties, where they matched up the Latin long latitudes, went and took pictures of there, did many interviews with hospital personnel and residents, and you could basically go online. This is all online now, of course. Click on that, and you pull up much more detailed information about what was going on. Hyperlinks that are in the stories take you off in different directions. And so the ability to tell stories and to enrich what the information platform that we're doing is just so much greater than we've got. We're still trying to figure out how to pay for all that, of course. The financial model is tough. Those of you who subscribe online, we thank you very much. I'll say that now. We're obviously tightening the number of stories you can read every month before you hit that paywall that we have. That's the model of the future. Our ad revenues, both from print and online, certainly print is going down. Online hasn't grown as fast as it could. So we're going to be looking to get more information from consumers, just as you buy other things online. That's very much the financial picture. We're much stronger than we were a year and a half ago, but it's a model that we're still fine-tuning with all our business folks in New York.
We have a number of questions about the current fighting in Gaza and nearby areas in Israel. And a couple of them kind of come along the lines of, the United States, quite appropriately, of course, has condemned Hamas for firing rockets into civilian areas of Israel. But they also point out that the far more people, it's up to at least 30-something at this point, civilians have been killed by Israelis bombing crowded areas in Gaza. And the question is basically, is this... With the United States continue to take such a one-sided view of the conflict, how that contributes to ongoing Islamic radicalism and anti-American extremism?
Well, certainly the Obama administration has said Israel's right of self-defense in this case, but it's also urged restraint on both sides. And I think there's a lot of behind-the-scenes activity going on, diplomatic activity right now. We've seen the president of Egypt inviting an Israeli envoy there to try and bring at least a ceasefire to this attack. But you're right. I mean, is the U.S., this gets back to my point about the narrative here, as the U.S. is firmly attached to the Israeli position here, it certainly makes it more difficult to engage with some of these newly governed countries, countries such as Egypt and President Morsi, who's in a very tough position of dealing with his base, the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, but also understanding that he needs Western aid, and he can't completely turn his back on that as well.
We have a question here asking if you are familiar with the TV series Homeland, and what do you think of its premise that Al-Qaeda could plant an operative within the U.S. government?
I'm a big fan of Homeland. I think that maybe stretched the boundaries of credibility, though, in terms of where he was able to get.
Mm-hmm. And another question about your personal travels and the like. How do you prepare for an overseas trip to a war zone? How much do you have to set up beforehand? And how do you deal with things like language barriers and your dependency on a minder or mm-hmm. translators?
Mm-hmm. Certainly, when I've deployed in embedding with American troops and in my deployments to Pakistan as well, where I'm kind of going up with local colleagues, you're oftentimes depending on the hot zone, if you will, if this is an active combat zone. The New York Times has taken great steps, particularly in recent years after the tragic loss of my colleague Anthony Shadid, to redouble its efforts and to make sure that reporters going into the conflict zones have the proper training or properly equipped, the right kind of body armor, the right kind of communications and backup plans. I think those are all very solid. You obviously are doing a lot of research before you go in, understanding the culture as best you can. If you don't speak the language, you have trusted fixers on the ground, or interpreters, translators who you work with. You're often relying on colleagues who've gone before you and in passing off trusted native speakers to you. We have a fabulous system of stringers around the world in countries like Pakistan, which I'm most familiar with, Pakistani journalists in this case, who we work very closely with and collaborate on stories and oftentimes rely on them for their judgment. They speak the language. They know the culture best. They know when we get into ticklish situations and potentially even dangerous situations where we need to pull back. And that's always the line for journalists covering conflict areas of how far do you push the envelope to get the good story. And I think it's an ongoing discussion that we reporters have with our editors in Washington and New York about what the need for the good story versus protecting, you know, the safety of the correspondents in general.
We have time for just one more question, and this involves the shift. Or the pivot or whatever they're calling it of a U.S. defense strategy focusing more on the Far East. Mm-hmm. And the question is, can we really get away with that given the continued threat from the Middle East?
Obviously President Obama has been in the Far East now. He's been in Burma, I think, today. First time a U.S. president has been there. But the crisis in the Middle East will keep pulling this administration and future administrations back to that region, whether it be the ongoing, the most current strife between Israel and Hamas, the severity of the Syrian crisis, the larger, I think, multi-year issue of we watch Arab Spring countries unfolding. This will pull back the attention and resources of this government, even as it rightly takes a harder look toward Asia. But I don't think it's possible at this moment for the U.S. to just kind of pick up and leave. And I think that's understood. I just did a conference with some Gulf scholars, and they're very worried about that, that the pivot might mean the U.S. is turning its back on that. But I just think the importance of what's going on, the issues in the region are going to demand America's attention and leadership now and for years to come.
Our thanks to Eric Schmidt, National Security Reporter for the New York Times and co-author of Counterstrike, The Untold Story of America's Secret Campaign Against Al-Qaeda. We also want to thank our audiences, both here and on radio, television, and the Internet. I'm Stephen Zunis, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned.